Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Transfigured. I am here with Jordan Hall. Jordan is a fascinating thinker and speaker. I mostly became aware of Jordan through his appearances on John Vervaeke's channel. You've had who knows how many conversations with John Vervaeke, more than I can count. And you've been a frequent guest and interlocutor with him. I also feel like you're the guest who brings out the fanciest of the fancy Vervaeke words from him that I've seen. And you recently converted to Christianity, although to be fair, I've wanted to interview you for a long time. I'm not just sort of bringing you on as for that reason, but that sort of, I guess it was the tipping point where it's like, oh man, I really need to talk to him now, I guess. But I find your takes on the crisis, meta crisis that sort of civilization is facing, how to address that with religion, how to think about religion, how to combine that with sort of a kind of system level or evolutionary biology, even level of thinking and all of those sorts of things. And hearing, I've been learning more about your personal story. It sounds absolutely fascinating. You sound like a very genuine and eager truth seeker that has taken you on all sorts of wild and unexpected places. So with that introduction, anything else you want to tell us about yourself?
Oh, I'm just laughing. I'm just remembering a moment very early on in my relationship with the woman who's now my wife. She looked at me. I can't remember even where we were, but there's just this beautiful look, like a good solid, like 2 second pause. And then she says, "You're a very unusual person." No, I think that probably puts that's like the best possible description.
Yes. Yeah. Well, this corner of the internet is full of unusual, unique people who somehow have something in common that find us here anyway. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit hard to put your finger on what exactly that in common is. But I guess eager truth seeking might be one of the most common traits, I guess, that I would say that brings us together. And so I guess I wanted to ask you, I know that you've been very involved with sort of Plan B and other sort of contingency, like disaster contingency thinking groups, I guess. I don't know what else to call it in the past. My first question for you would be is what are the crises that you feel like our civilization is facing or could be facing in, you know, at least an imaginably near future?
Well, let me start actually by maybe disambiguating. It's actually Game B.
Game B. Sorry, and Plan B is something else. Yes, Game B.
and it's really not, in some sense at all, about disaster preparedness. Although, as it turns out, as an adjunct consequence, you know, if you're looking at, let's just say things for the moment, if you're looking at things and you're paying close attention and you're like, you're noticing that something like disaster seems to be coming rather rapidly, then you'd be rather foolish not to prepare. And so there is a disaster preparedness element, but that's not was never the point. It was not the essence of it, let's say. But I say the answer to your question is sort of everything. That's kind of the point of the notion of the meta crisis. It might be easier to do the apophatic method, to do the Buddhist like point to that which is not in crisis. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure there is anything. Maybe shoot, even the laws of physics might be up for grabs. So the insight of the meta crisis, and maybe I can even like maybe pull it in a bit of an order. You would have something like a crisis, and here you can pick any particular domain. You could pick a financial crisis, or the collapsing testosterone crisis, or the soil biome crisis. Right? These are obviously circumstances where some particular trajectory, the dynamics of the system are moving in a direction. And if you forward project that direction, you notice that there is a terminus to the integrity of the system, meaning the trajectory cannot continue as it is. that's crisis, right? Crisis just means this cannot continue. Something significant, some kind of significant change has to occur. Something has to terminate. And so in my particular life arc, what ended up happening was, is I found myself in a situation where I was, you know, pulling on the thread here, noticing that some particular system was in crisis. And then I'd go talk with people who were domain experts in some completely different domain, just out of curiosity, just because I was interested in talking to people about what, you know, about things, and noticing that they were also noticing something in the direction of crisis. Another domain, another domain. So we start to list a large list of crises. Then we can start talking about this term polycrisis, which to me is actually kind of a nonsense term, just means a bunch of crises, which is true. But it's weirdly distracting because it implies almost like a, oh, well, that's weird. We kind of seem to be in a situation where there's a bunch of crises, but does not at all imply that they're connected in any meaningful fashion.
Right.
It might orient you to the fact that they're going to have data effects. So I've got crisis one over here and crisis two. Let's say I've got a hurricane that is hitting it exactly the same time, but I also, for some reason, have a, let's just make it a terrorist act that takes out the electrical grid. I've got two distinct crises that are not coupled in the obvious sense, but they're impacting each other. So the polycrisis can at least give rise to the notion of, hey, you're going to have to think about the fact that there's a number of distinct crises, but their secondary and tertiary effects are going to interact with each other. All right, fair enough. But in my personal investigation, and then increasingly finding myself in collaboration with other people who are finding the same, ended up following the same thread, or pulling on the thread from a different location, and we came together and we're like sharing information, perspectives, going, oh, we're seeing the same thing. Many of whom were completely unknown at the time. Many of whom are actually relatively known now. So that's interesting as a data point, by the way. Meta crisis. This is pointing to the notion of there is actually a coupling. There's something going on here that is happening at, let's say, in my case, I will think deeper as opposed to higher. The word meta tends to mean up or whatever. And we're not going to be able to address the more superficial elements of what's happening if we can't actually perceive and address the deeper elements. Okay, if that's, and of course, this is a relatively trivial statement. This is the whole symptoms cause medical problem. If you simply address the symptoms, you're not addressing the underlying cause, that you're not really healing anybody. And then, of course, the question is, well, what does it mean to get to the bottom, to the root, to the deepest cause? Mm-hmm. So that was the journey that, for me, was characterized by a project called the Deep Code Project. I was coming from a more of a technical world, so the word code was part of it. You get it. Yeah. And so the notion of the metacrisis for me represents the diagnosis that there are, in fact, extremely deep causes. Like the actual crisis is happening at a profoundly deep level. And that, therefore, in order to respond to it properly, we need to be thinking about how to respond to it from an appropriately deep and holistic level.
So what would you say if you were to tug on these strings is at the root? Why are there so many? What if there's a polycrisis, what does seem to be uniting them? Is it just the exponential growth of human civilization that is finally butting up against constraints? Is it some hubris in the way that we've developed civilization, or are these things that are coming that are mostly outside of human cause? How would you, if you had to dig down to the root of the thing that unites the Hydra, what do you think it is?
Well, let me do it in 3.5 steps.
Sure.
So the first step, the first assertion would be something like the nature of civilization itself. So my friend Daniel Schmachtenberger, and I think he coined the term. If he didn't, he certainly popularized it. Inexorably self-terminating. Mm-hmm. So the notion is that this thing, which we may have to describe what I mean by civilization, but this thing, civilization, is the kind of thing that is inexorably self-terminating. It has a secular cycle. It has a sort of a birth, maturity, and death arc to it. And so that's the first. The first point is to say, hey, it turns out that when you move into the category known as civilization, you're dealing with something that has its own, its crisis, its death built in. The second piece is, this is tied to the notion of tainter, or I think these are roughly the same basic category of Kuhn, which is that we don't yet actually have a way of engaging in paradigm shifts.
Mm-hmm.
Kuhn talks about them in terms of paradigm shifts. We don't actually do paradigm shifts. We do paradigm catastrophes. That's how we navigate from paradigm to paradigm. And so in the structure of the paradigms, as Kuhn analyzed it, is actually very close to the structure of civilizations. It's a connection between the two. So it's a good, it's a model. The two models are quite similar. And so the fact that we navigate between paradigms, which is to say the fact that we navigate the inevitable decline and fall of a civilization by means of catastrophe, okay, that's the next step. And there's notice a little glimmer of hope there that maybe we could do it by means of something like shift or growth, maturity. The third step, and this is speaking to a little bit of what you just mentioned, is that for the first time in history, we actually girdle the globe with what is effectively a single connected civilization structure. So we're all connected, and so we can't have, historically what's happened is we've had a collapse. The collapse has been relatively localized. So the rest of the world, the rest of the human species and all the different cultures were doing their own thing, and they were on different cycles, different dynamics, different premises, and so they weren't fully entrained. But now we're fully entrained. And then we can plus, or in that same category, we can talk about also that the amount of power that we're operating with is also historically novel. We're dealing with the very first time we have an adequate amount of power that we can actually crack the natural layer. We can destroy the underlying substrate that has always supported the anthropological layer. So both of those are true. We have simultaneously, everything is included. We're fully entrained with very limited exceptions, micro exceptions. And we have a historically novel degree of power. So, and then I guess maybe so go ahead.
So that correlates our fate together of the various parts of the world in a way that hasn't been true.
Quite true.
Previously, if a Mayan civilization were to collapse, then it's not like the Chinese particularly noticed and those sorts of things. But now with integration comes interdependence, and with interdependence comes a shared fate for better or for worse.
Correct. Yes, this is correct.
And so, all right, so you named, there's something about civilization that is inexorably self-terminating. We are growing in interconnection to the point of sort of a monoculture, as I've heard it called, and that we are using energy at a rate that is also unprecedented. But hey, what's wrong with that? We have more energy for more people, and more people are plugged in. Doesn't sound like a crisis necessarily. Oh,
I didn't mean to imply energy in the sense of using more energy. When by power, what I mean is like the ability of nuclear bombs to kill everything.
Ah, okay. All right. So not just pure calories or gigawatts flowing through the system.
There's nothing
degrees of
wrong with that.
Degrees of technical ability and freedom or something like that.
Okay. Perturbation capacity, the ability to perturb the system. And then both at the level of gross capacity and at the level of, what would you call them, subtle points. For example, the classic like Vulcan neck pinch, I can knock you out by punching you in the face Mike Tyson style, or I can knock you out by giving you the Vulcan neck pinch. In either case, you're unconscious. And so we have simultaneously power that is hitting at very precise and sensitive points, that's what I mean, sensitive points in complex systems. And then we also just have significant amounts of just raw power that we're pushing against the sensitive systems and many different variations between at historically novel levels and, as far as we can tell, increasingly so.
Mm-hmm. So we have growing abilities and a growing interconnectedness, but seemingly perhaps our wisdom hasn't grown as fast as our ability. Like, I've got three little kids in my house, and there are phases where their abilities seem to outstrip their wisdom, such as, I've learned the ability to climb up things, but I do not know what I should and shouldn't climb up. That's a dangerous phase for a parent. It requires a lot of attention when a child has suddenly learned that they can get up high on things, climb up on tables, climb up on shelves, but they don't know the wisdom which when and how to climb up them. That right. sort of seems like a metaphor that we've gained some abilities faster than seemingly our wisdom to know how to okay. use them well.
I mean, the classic example that I literally encountered last week is the Book of Matches. Mm-hmm. So climbing up things is a very human thing to do. So at least in principle, there's a symmetry between our wisdom and our capacity. Now, obviously, our built environment includes things that can be climbed up that are not anthropologically natural. So it's harder for us to map to. But a match is a completely novel phenomenon in the mm-hmm. our anthropological history. And of course, it presents a capacity to create fire, which presents a capacity to burn everything down that is far outside of our development, by our developmental, I mean our anthropological, evolved developmental context. And so that presents a kind of a category of the challenge that we run into, our ability to use intelligence to discern the characteristics of reality, to afford new capacities, which to increase our power, our ability to present our will to produce desired changes in the world, is not connected to our, at least our inherited capacity to make effective choices. And it appears to be the case that we don't have, at least for some significant period of time, we have not found ways to maintain anything like a symmetry between our wisdom or our capacity to make proper choices with our power or our capacity to produce choices that affect change in the world.
Yeah. So as humans, we have an evolved ability to learn things faster than pure biological change. Our brains give us a lot of plasticity and adaptability and some amount of programmability where we can learn things that are not native to our sort of, you know, ancestral deep past, but like sort of related to the example I made of children climbing up things. We have sort of a natural inborn fear of heights or a sense of, I look down and I see a really big distance down. I should back away from the edge of this cliff. You know, that's deeper than just even humanity. Lots of animals know to be wary of things that look like a falling off place. And that's been built up over a long period of time. And maybe there's that age at about 18 months where adventurousness slightly outstrips wisdom, but it's perhaps not too dangerous. But that our adaptability has created our ability to generate technology, but we are changing our environment way faster than biology can pick up or adapt. A lot of our crises seem related to that. Like a lot of our health crises, you know, an obesity epidemic is seemingly related to our ability to produce tasty, yummy foods has outstripped our wisdom of knowing what to eat and how much to eat. Mm-hmm. And that could be, you know, just an example of all sorts of things where we have, our technology has enabled us to make decisions that gratify our desires. And these desires were honed for a different environment that had different constraints and affordances. And so now we're making ourselves sick by pleasing ourselves too much. Mm-hmm. And you could apply that to food or sex or all sorts of different appetites that humans have. And that this technological outpacing of our biological adaptation is causing all sorts of problems and forcing us to use sort of like our will and our cognitive faculties and our executive discipline or something to try and patch over these, you know, perhaps biological deficiencies. But that is difficult and hard and doesn't always work perfectly well either.
Right, right. I'm trying to see. So let's see.
So I guess the question that I'll ask you following up on that is one of the crises, especially that we like to talk about in John Vervaeke related circles, is the meaning crisis. So in your estimation, how does the meaning crisis sort of fit into that? Is this something similar to an obesity crisis where we have sort of our technology has outpaced our natural ability to adapt things? And so we've almost like overrode our meaning circuitry in a way that diabetes is overloading our glucose circuitry, that we have almost made things so hyper meaningful that it has like kind of broken our meaning receptors or something like that. Or is that perhaps not the right analogy?
It's one level more fundamental than that. So it includes that. Mm-hmm. But it's actually one level more fundamental. And you're sort of you're edging in there a moment ago when you were talking about the how we try to address it problem. And so first order, we have something like salience and super salience. So our ability to take things that are constitutive of meaningfulness and to substitute things that are a less meaningful but more salient version. This is the problem of our ability to satisfy our desires but not to actually meet our needs. Right? So that's the way of describing this problem that we have. You know, if we are deeply wise and deeply embodied in our wisdom, our choices will meet our needs. But to the degree which our power outstrips our wisdom, our ability to satisfy our desires, which is to say our ability to do the things we think we want, gets stronger, but our ability to map what we think we want with what we actually need creates a gap. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's the first order, right? So this is of the same kind as nutrition. Like it's the cotton candy effect at the level of meaningfulness. But of course, meaningfulness is profound, more profound than nutrition, because meaningfulness is associated with our, let's say, our metacapacity or our capacity to be wise. So we're not just disrupting a particular system, we're disrupting the system which is responsible for governing the way that we keep our choices in alignment with our actual needs. So it's actually a deeper fundamental problem. And this happens, by the way, at the level of individuals and at the level of civilization and cultures.
And
so this is the place where if we fall off just an iota too far on the level of the meaning crisis, it's unrecoverable, because that's the thing upon which we depend for recovery.
Right. We use wisdom to, like, I like the way that you brought up the distinction between desires and needs, because theoretically our bodies are evolving our desires to be as closely in line with our needs as it can. But like we've said, we have changed our environment quicker than our biology is able to adapt our sort of desire structure. And so we have this kind of bridge in between that we use wisdom to help fill. Like, actually, you know, you shouldn't eat too much cotton candy. You should, you know, make yourself exercise more than you seem to naturally need to. You know, all of these sorts of things. And then we need to go through a process of sort of self-discipline to get ourselves to do the things that we know that we need to do. And it's, you know, we often think that this is very individual, but we're very porous creatures. We're very influenced by the people around us. Our culture, our friends, our social network help us do these sorts of things. And our decisions also influence other people in those. So the wisdom is the thing that can help mediate between the gap between our desires and our needs, that can help us adapt to a changing landscape. But there's some crisis that is affecting even our ability to do that. And that's part of what we mean by the meaning crisis. So how exactly is that faculty being disrupted?
Well, you mentioned a really great example. So we learn most often by emulation. So we learn by experience, but we also learn more by emulation, for the obvious reason that the sum total of everybody else's experience is much larger than our individual experience. And so if I encounter somebody who has lived life already and I watch how they do it, then I can learn something from them with two great advantages. One, they've refined. Let's just make a simple example, like learning how to make fire with wood. You know, if I try to figure that out from first principles by just trying iteratively, maybe eventually I'll figure it out, but that's going to be a long journey. Whereas if I'm encountering an elder who's already mastered that skill, I can zoom in very quickly on the relevant characteristics, even if it's not necessarily with intelligence, just by watching, and I'll get to the end result rapidly. So we learn largely by emulation. Okay. Now, what our culture does is our culture hijacks that emulation trigger. This is something called like celebrity, by giving us things that have a very high degree of salience in observation, but don't actually provide anything vaguely like proper wisdom. So I hate to break it to you. I'm a little bit dated here, but the Kardashians are not the ones to emulate. There's nothing, there's no content in the lifestyle of the Kardashians that will nurture your soul or build your wisdom. In fact, quite the opposite, it'll actually take you further away. And so what happens is, because our culture has, because the nature of this crisis is boiling up in lots of different areas, our attention allocation system has become an object of what is effectively parasitism. There's a parasite sitting on top of our collective attention allocation system, and it hijacks our emulation circuits, which are critical to our learning capacity, and puts something into our emulation circuits, which are in fact super salient, like cotton candy. So that's one example. There's many more, by the way. Let's actually go to the second one. The second one is just as profound and even harder. And this has to do with the stuff that, well, I use Ian McGilchrist because I think both his diagnosis and his prescription are the best. And this has to do with the our particular culture, which now increasingly is global, has become trapped, in some sense addicted to, a particular style of how to think about what proper solutions to problems look like. Analytic, reductive, largely materialist, causal sensibility, which he would describe as sort of a left brain approach. And so what ends up happening there is that we do something like say, okay, we're having trouble with nutrition. And instead of cultivating wisdom, what we're going to do is we're going to create more analytic knowledge. We're going to become better. We build the science of nutrition, nutrition's science. And that actually has two problems. One is that you get information overwhelm. Nobody can actually parse the information contained in nutrition science. And the methodology of analytic information processing is, in fact, epistemologically inappropriate to actual whole systems. You can't integrate across a large amount of analytic data. You're a data scientist. You can't integrate across a large amount of analytic data and actually produce a whole system, which has, for example, high sensitive dependence on initial conditions and nonlinear feedback loops. If you miss even a small amount, you may actually produce a completely wrong result. So you combine those two problems, information overwhelm, it's very difficult to track all of the information. And by the way, you're never going to capture all the information, so you may be missing critical elements. And the notion of what's critical is extraordinarily difficult to actually identify. You can't do like an 80-20 rule and think you got it. You may have been right, precisely got it completely wrong. And so again, so this is like that notion of like a couple of steps deep. We have a methodology, this particular scientific approach, which is very useful, but we've now identified it as being the whole of how to approach different problems. And so what that does is that actually locks us into a process where our attention and energy, our wisdom, the thing that would be better used to cultivate wisdom is in fact being repurposed to build more knowledge and intelligence, which is categorically the wrong solution.
So right.
Declining our capacity to do the thing we need to do and investing all of our energy in something that won't work.
So one of a project that I was involved on earlier in my career, I was working for a large grocery store conglomerate in their health analytics division. And I proposed a project that was, well, hey, let's make a predictive model of what groceries you buy predict your health. And then once we have said model, then we'll turn that around and we could make healthy grocery shopping recommendations or something like that. Maybe pair that with like some recipes or something like that. And judge the healthiness of the recipes using this predictive model and help people have like a smart shopping and meal planning app that guides them in both a delicious and healthy direction. And for the record, I actually still think that was a relatively good idea. I still think it could have worked. It kind of basically ran into problems because COVID happened, I guess. Uh-huh. That's sort of the short answer. Maybe I didn't do a good enough job pitching it either. But in any way, the problem was, though, is how exactly do you define healthy? And because when you're making these models, you need a target variable that's like move in this direction. And so like the best approximation that I could come up with is like, okay, so we also have pharmacies in these grocery stores. So we know what some subset of the grocery store shopping population, we know what drugs they're taking. And so we can then have a relatively good idea about what health conditions they may or may not have. And so then you could like kind of turn that. It's like, okay, if you have diabetes, then like that's minus 100 brownie points. if you're on beta blockers, well, you know, minus 20, I don't know, like something like that, and try and turn it into a numeric score for healthiness. But I actually think kind of deep within that example is one of the limitations of AI, that it needs a quantifiable variable to optimize. Mm-hmm. And things like health might not ever in the final analysis boil down to something like that. And that there's some sort of, I don't know, interactive, telos seeking process that we have within ourselves that's trying to get after health, but it is not in the final analysis ever going to be very quantifiable.
Oh, and if just dig double clicking that a few times, because you'll get the category of health. If you can go down and think about the set of interlocking characteristics of the category that you might call, say, I don't know, physical well-being or not being sick or something like that. And of course, there's a combinatorial explosion in the downward facing direction. But look what happens when you flip it on the other side and think about, well, what does that mean in terms of like your healthy relationships, your mental health, but also, by the way, the word telos, like what's actually healthy in the context of the arc of your whole life? Like, Maybe it was necessary for you to have this exposure to a particular ailment, for you to go through the psycho-emotional, spiritual development necessary to get to where you are now. Like, oh crap, now what do I do? Like, if I could like retroactively erase that, is there some way? And the point is there any way, in principle, of being able to predictively model that total all of these different modal constructs? And the answer, by the way, is in fact, as far as I can tell, no. At least not using an algorithmic approach that has any finite, even a very large amount of information, but a finite amount of information.
Right. Like, is a super marathon runner healthy? Many of us might think so. Oh man, running is healthy. So if you're running, you know, if you can run a marathon super fast or even further than a marathon super fast, you might be really healthy. Well, look at their knees and their ankles and their joints, and you might find that your own knees and joints are actually probably healthier than the super marathon runners. And they might even be stressing their heart in a way that could have long-term consequences. But yet, if you know someone needs to run 40 miles in a short period of time, what is healthy exactly? Is a weight, is your, you know, the most muscular weightlifter that you can possibly imagine healthy? You know,
they're look at the super marathon runner's relationship with their kids.
Like
maybe if you zoom out, you might look at ways that addressing the problem of the health of their knees, but it may be that what's going on is actually also associated with a very unhealthy relationship with their kids. It's connected in some meaningful way, not trivial, not arbitrarily. Mm-hmm. And so you expand out to the whole self. If you integrate the whole self and all of the qualities of the self and all the qualities of the relationships that the self can be in, and you begin to realize this is a very complex problem.
Right. My wife and I are watching the show Alone on Netflix, which is actually would recommend it. It's a pretty entertaining show. They drop 10 people off like in the woods in Canada, and they get to bring a very short list of items. And it's basically a survival competition. How long can you survive in the woods alone? And the winner gets, you know, a pile of money. And you'll notice that one of the things that really helps is going into the competition very overweight, because you can't bring food with you, but you can bring body fat on your body with you. Mm. And so that reminds us that there actually is a survival point to storing up large amounts of body fat, is that it's a starvation insurance program. We don't
also true for being thrown overboard out of a boat.
Yeah. You're more buoyant, more well insulated, less likely to get hypothermia, et cetera. So it's not like there aren't advantages to being overweight. It just depends on the context. And, if you're a hunter-gatherer tribe that needs to persistence hunt antelope every day to get antelope, being a super marathoner or at least having that capability is going to be very helpful if you need to chase antelope till they, you know, faint of exhaustion before you faint of exhaustion. Being a super marathoner is going to be very important and will help your relationship with your children by giving them food. But if you are addicted to the high of running and you're neglecting your children or neglecting investing in other areas of your life. So yeah, this question of what health means was hard to boil down into an algorithm, I'll say.
Yeah. And yeah, in fact, the premise might be something like it can't and shouldn't be boiled down to an algorithm.
Because if you make go ahead.
I was going to say, this gets to that point of what is at the core of why civilization is inexorably self-terminating. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And one of the great examples that I ran into about 5 or 6 years ago is the story of what happens when you show a photograph of a man walking in the woods to a civilized person, which is to say, let's just for the moment just make it a Western person, but it could have been like a Sumerian, in comparison to an indigenous person. And the person who's coming from England will look at it and they'll narrate it the way I narrated it. Oh, that's a picture of a man walking in the woods. The indigenous person will say, that's a picture of the woods. Oh, and yes, there's a man in there too. Mm-hmm. There's a foreground background inversion, there's a flip. And it has to do with, are you foregrounding context or are you foregrounding content? Mm-hmm. The analytic methodology, the algorithmic methodology, foregrounds content and then tries to produce increasingly narrow edge. It perceives context as a recursive process of endeavoring to identify and map to edge cases. So it ingests context as a form of an extrapolation of content. And that's actually very much at the center of the core of the problem.
Mm-hmm. So, and does that sort of track with McGilchrist left brain, right brain sort of stuff? That yes. A right brain thing is more attentive to context and a left brain is more attentive to content.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. So how does an overly left-brained approach, what are the problems that causes? Because if like my, you know, the example of my AI diet menu recommender grocery shopping tool, that's a super left-brained approach to the problem. What are the sorts of problems that it causes? And I'll take half a shot at answering my own question. Mm-hmm. Like, let's imagine we have some mathematical definition of healthiness, but it's not perfect. And we amp this up with gigantic powers of AI predictability, and we have millions of grocery shoppers across the United States listening to the advice of this thing. Any deviation between your mathematical approximation of healthiness and what we might call true healthiness behind that are going to get mathematically amplified in such a way that will have very unpredictable but probably negative consequences. There might mm-hmm. be some good consequences in there to the extent that you're helping someone approximate health, but the distortions in your model will surprise you, probably.
Let's do the double loop again. And I think if we hold this here, we can kind of get things very clear. The category of problem that it produces is it produces polycrises. Mm-hmm. So it's funny, like, okay, that's what we're talking about. And you just described how and why that happened. Where you have a system and where that system has complex feedback loops and sensitive points, and where your model does not in fact fully perfectly map to that. And of course, we can, I'd argue epistemologically, no model could. As you increase the amount of energy or resource that is flowing through the system according to your model, you're beginning to break down the feedback loops that are intrinsic to the true healthiness, let's say. Mm-hmm. And then what that does is that puts pressure on the sensitive points. Now, here's the second order problem. The second order problem is if you are addicted to this methodology, if you can't actually have both methodologies operate in concert, then what happens is you end up with paradigm catastrophe, meaning you double down. As opposed to reducing the activity you're engaging in, you do more of it. Now, what you might do more of it is say, okay, oh, let me run this process again at a finer grained level. I can include more edge cases. I can include more points where the sensitivity analysis is off. But this actually has a higher carrying cost because you've now got a more complicated system that you're designing to try to manage this underlying complexity. Mm-hmm. And it, because it's more fine grained, what it does is it actually ends up being more capable of putting perturbations on incredibly sensitive points. Mm-hmm. It actually is getting more intimate into the feedback loops of the structure. And so as it gets more and more complicated, it gets harder and harder to manage. It's harder and harder for you to know what's actually going on. If you're addicted to a methodology, you find yourself in a situation where you will push the system to a crisis because the crisis becomes how you even notice that something's going on. Like something, you have to, things have to begin breaking for you to begin being able to notice that your model is in error. But of course, the problem is if you have fragility in the system, and fragility is a characteristic of complexity, meaning because complexity has resilience or robustness and multiple feedback loops, you don't notice that you're killing it because it looks like it's doing okay, even as you're breaking things in various subtle ways. So even as you're slicing little tiny bits here and there, the system as a whole is hanging together. So your measurement techniques are observing, oh, it's okay. In fact, it may actually be getting better because your measurement techniques are measuring only a subset of all the
characteristics. Yeah.
Maybe optimizing very well against the subset that you care about, and you're blind to the subset that you're not noticing. And you can't see the dynamical, the collapse, the hollowing out of the complexity until a crisis of adequate magnitude occurs. So that's the problem.
And Verveke talks a lot about the efficiency resiliency trade-off, that there's a trade-off between how resilient you are and how efficient you are. Yep. Like you can imagine, you know, a very lean marathon runner who has no body fat and a super good metabolism. Well, they're very efficient, but if you put them on the alone show and they have a super low BMI, they're going to be beat by the person who is actually sort of a couch potato, who's actually good at shooting a bow and arrow, because that person had some resiliency, even at the expense of efficiency.
And this example make it even more intense. So it doesn't have to be that far apart. So let's say you've got this ultra marathon runner who's perfectly optimized. Let's say really like as far as the human body can go for 100-mile races. Even if all you do is ask them to run a 15-mile race, we're not even talking about the alone show.
No,
they're going to underperform effectively everybody else because they've become hyper optimized. And there's a whole bunch of things that they were traded off that they got rid of in order to fit that niche. By the way, evolutionary theory does this well. I call it the saber tooth tiger problem. As a particular organism, and by the way, if a niche is constant long enough, organisms become increasingly efficiently mapped to that niche. Which means, on the flip side of this, they will become increasingly fragile to increasingly smaller perturbations in the characteristics of the niche. That's the same. We're saying the same thing now again with regard to what happens with our style of optimization.
So stability encourages efficiency to outcompete resiliency. But sometimes stability can be deceiving because periods of stability can be followed by periods of instability. And then all, you know, and that's to a large extent, that's often what economic recessions are, is things that have been outcompeting their competition through efficiency gains, then all of a sudden face a slightly change in the system, and they aren't resilient enough to handle it. And then that causes, you know, some amount of systems collapse until other things that had the resiliency to survive it rise up and take their stead. But the longer it is between sort of these forest fires of recessions, the longer efficiency has been beating resiliency and the deeper the problem can be.
And, the smaller the forest fire needs to be to begin the cascade effect of the depth of the problem. So you actually have both.
Yes.
The fall gets deeper and the perturbation to cause the fall gets smaller. Right? And that is systemic crisis. Like, that's it right there.
Right. And so we've been living in perhaps a remarkably and unusually stable world since, let's say, the end of World War II. And a lot of our systems are built up to be hyper-efficient in the form of stability afforded since then. And I can't help but feel that some of the cracks in the World War II, post-World War II order are starting to show signs of change. I'll just put it that way. And the efficiency of our system, you know, if like a globalized system where Vietnam is super highly efficient at producing Nike sneakers and Taiwan is super hyper efficient at producing, you know, microchips and Germany is super efficient at producing luxury vehicles, et cetera. And all of this relies on the free, you know, access to the seas to trade all of these different components in the supply chain together. We kind of saw this in COVID, that, you know, disruptions to the supply chains could cause all sorts of weird problems. Well, what if there's a war on the high seas and that boats can't go between Taiwan and Germany, or at least not as easily anymore? Mm-hmm. You know, and that could then cause severe systems collapse because we've had 80-ish years of hyper-efficiency seeking in a very stable world, and that stability is no longer able to be taken for granted.
Right. And now run that same. So, yes, agree. And notice that there's systemic mapping between things like supply chains and the fragility of organisms in the context of niches. I think these are actually the same kinds of system dynamics, even though we're talking about very different kinds of systems.
Yeah.
So we can do the same thing back to that concept of wisdom and the hijacking of our emulation models. And think about this metaphor earlier of when you're optimizing for certain metrics, you will also, you're looking at those metrics as truth, but there is a consequence, you're blind to other things that are going on.
Yeah.
So you think you're winning, when in fact what's actually happening is you're losing in very subtle ways that you can't perceive.
You're obsessed with your approximation, but you're unable to notice the gap in the distance between your approximation and the full thing that you're seeking.
Yep. Now, if you run both of those, so the Kardashian problem with the approximation problem, you get this really powerful feedback loop where, to the degree to which you can simply fool people into believing that they are having quality experiences, then you don't have to actually deal with providing them with well-being.
Right.
This is hijacking the salience landscape, which is a big part of what our culture has actually become optimized for. Our culture has sort of reduced itself down to the thinnest layer of our ability to perceive what is real and true, what we need as opposed to what we desire, is the object for which the system, the culture is optimized to tap into and hijack that. So it combines those two problems together. Mm-hmm. So not only are we overwhelmed with information in the category of nutrition, but we're also overwhelmed with the fact that there's a vast system that does nothing but try to greenwash everything. So mm-hmm. as soon as a new metric shows up, it's like, okay, maybe organic. I don't know. Organic is no longer a valid symbol because that symbol has now been identified as a super salient optimization technique. And all of the possible externalities that could be thrown into your cognitive or physical environment that aren't yet captured by some system that's trying to use governance on top of it will be, right? So that's basically a primary rule. All information that can be, let's say, right, all externalities that can be exploited because they're fitting in some blind spot will be exploited because they're fitting in that blind spot. And there will be a tacit conspiracy to hold that blind spot in blindness as long as the cybernetic control structures that are exploiting that niche are able to more effectively influence your governance infrastructure than you can. And so notice how that's like, that's a third order move. So now what you have is you have something like an adversarial parasite, which lives in the gaps that we were talking about in the first moves. And it has its own incentive landscape is to hold open and maintain your addiction. So this is like, you know, in some sense, there's almost an egregoric sensibility. If you're addicted to alcohol, the notion of alcohol being like, or drug being a monkey on your back, it speaks to it as almost a sort of agency. Now, in this case, we're talking about things that actually do have agency. You know, there are vast industries that I can't help but have at the industrial level, not necessarily the individuals involved, but they're trapped in incentive landscapes and information overwhelm and their own, you know, drift into being addled and outside of wisdom. But the industries are clearly incentivized to maintain our addiction. And so we get plenty of examples of this. I remember the classic for me when I was growing up was the oil industry deliberately obfuscating the research that said that lead was in gasoline was bad for us.
Right.
Very well documented. That was a thing that happened. And that's an example. But of course, that's an omnipresent example. So now we have three distinct elements that are happening in how the meta crisis is playing out, why it's playing out the way it's playing out.
Mm-hmm. And so there are these sort of, I don't know, egregoric parasites that can, you know, the interplay between sort of like the incentive that's existing at some sort of disembodied level, and then the people who become sort of involved in that industry or something who help give that, you know, incentive or egregore body in the world. Like, I think one of the best songs about this is Metallica's Master of Puppets, which is, I mean, basically about cocaine addiction. And so there is this wrestle of the inner person between, you know, wanting to do cocaine and wanting to not do cocaine. And you're hoping to get something out of your cocaine use, but it never ends up delivering. And it just feels like it's laughing at you and that there's this puppeteer controlling you. But for every person who's giving into cocaine, that's creating this incentive for the cocaine industry and the, you know, the Scarface-like figures of the world to be taking advantage of the people who are trapped in that. And that goes all the way down to the coca farmers in Colombia and the drug smugglers in Mexico, et cetera, et cetera. And so there's this body that emerges that is sort of like this thing that it gains body and power by tapping into the weaknesses of individuals. And, yep, you know, the cocaine industry is perhaps a particularly evil and obvious one, but sometimes it's these things that might, you know, like we do kind of need a gasoline industry, but preferably we want one that isn't going to lie to us about the harmful effects of lead to save a little bit on its bottom line in the short term. But even though if the gasoline industry were to think about it, like in the over the longest term, it wants a healthy customer base because, you know, a healthy, flourishing human civilization will need more gasoline than a lead infested, sick, not growing as much one. But in this short term thing, it's like, well, in the, for the next couple quarters, if I don't have to install the thing at my refinery to get the lead out of the gasoline, that will save me some money, even though it's parasitically stealing from the future in that perspective.
Yeah, back to the wisdom gap. What, the ability to, what's it, the marshmallow or the cookie test? Mm-hmm. The ability to not trade the long term for the short term is a matter of character. And that matter of character is grounded as a matter of wisdom. So yeah, the cultivation of character is a primary responsibility of anything that wants to endure that includes humans. And it has to be grounded in wisdom to be able to do so. And because we have this asymmetry between our ability to change our environment, you see these, you begin to get these cascade effects where those who play in the gap in the short term get a local selective advantage, and they end up, there ends up being a tacit, or how I say it, a tacit unconscious conspiracy. But they're not working together on the, consciously. But because everybody in that category in the gap is taking advantage of their local selective advantage by gaming the asymmetry between our new power and our embodied wisdom and character, they are working together to separate us, to render us less and less capable of responding to it through whatever means they do. Your example of the cocaine industry is to the point. And by the way, think about how you'll see things like, I don't know, degrading the effectiveness of policing. It becomes an obvious evolutionary advantage for criminal enterprise. Well, they're going to end up engaging in a tacit conspiracy to degrade policing effectiveness. And that comes through corruption, and it comes through defunding, it comes through propaganda, it comes through overwhelm, through a variety of different, like there's so many different ways. And it doesn't have to be any given individual or group of individuals thinking it through intelligently. It could happen through just a series of bottom-up explorations of just things that tend to work over long enough periods of time. This is that moderation. Is this, if the niche stays stable long enough, a whole variety of things begin to occur.
So
we're delving deeply into the meta crisis.
Yeah. Okay. So I'll take a little bit of a left turn, although I think it's very related to what we've been talking, and we'll complement that, is what exactly is religion? And I this is a question that it's sort of been a sub theme of my YouTube channel, is sort of this interface between evolutionary biology, anthropology, and philosophy of religion. A little personal biographical. I grew up in a church that was very skeptical of Darwinism and evolution. I'll just put it that way. And viewed basically Darwinism as something like an anti-Christian conspiracy to undermine faith propagated by the intellectual elite or something like that. And then that caused something of a personal meta crisis in college where I'm like, okay, well, I'm studying biostatistics. And, you know, some of these evolutionary biologists have some points. and some of this data is a little bit, okay, this is getting a little bit hard to make sense of otherwise. I'll just put it that way. And that causing, you know, some difficulty for me based off of, that. but
it's technically called a crisis of faith.
A crisis of faith, yeah. And you know, figuring out how to navigate that, I'm not sure if I quite have the answer figured out yet, but it's an interesting question. And part of that question has led me, well, you know, you can actually use evolutionary understanding to understand what religion is. But is that going to be a deconstructive thing where it's like, ha, I know what religion is. You're just like trying to create superorganisms or something like that. And to tap into people's sense of meaning with these metaphorical stories about heaven and hell and redemption and purity and impurity, etc. And it's this basically this thing that's lying to you, but it has an evolutionary benefit. And it's like, well, how... If we're going to say that there's lying and that there's a benefit, like we can say that there's short-term benefit to lying, like the gasoline industry lying about lead, but that will eventually be a self-defeating, a self-terminating process. So if we generally think that lying is something that you do that is going against the long-term success of something, then it would seem to be that whatever is moving in the highest long-term benefit, therefore, would have to be whatever have to be the truth, kind of by definition. And so if a religion really is doing the thing that is aiming at the longest-term survivability, then it theoretically couldn't be lying and would have to be the truth. And that sort of comes to the question of, does the success of a religion, assuming that religions are these evolved things, does that give credibility to its sort of, I don't know, metaphysical or otherwise otherworldly claims? And so anyway, that's just a train of thought that I've been exploring with a couple of people. I've talked with Verveke about that multiple times. David Sloan Wilson, I think, is an extremely interesting evolutionary biologist who thinks about those questions a lot. Brett Weinstein thinks about those a lot, although I tend to disagree with his takes on that. But anyway, I'll throw it back over to you. What is religion? And I've heard you talk about it in similar kind of evolutionary understanding ways. Sure. How do you make sense of those sorts of thoughts and questions?
All right. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to set up a way of thinking about it. And then I'm going to walk through the way of thinking. I'm going to walk through it through the different ways of thinking about it. That actually ends up being quite important. And I'll do it maybe just to a basic lens of epistemology. So there's three distinct kinds, but I'm just going to talk about two. So the first kind is what I would identify as the scientific and journalistic mode of epistemology, which in Verveckian language is largely, almost entirely about the coordination of propositions and observables or states of affairs. And so think about that as just the scientific method. We say something, we make a hypothesis, we utter a proposition, and then we endeavor to observe states of affairs and see if they are, in fact, the same. You would say fire is hot is a very simple scientific assertion. It's a proposition. I then engage in some set of experiments. I put some instrument in my hand in relationship with fire and verify whether or not the content of the proposition hot is mapped to the experience or the phenomenon of under investigation. And so that's scientific and journalistic mode of truth. So scientific truth is of the category of propositions that through some methodology of observation maps to what we could call observables. Now notice that I had to put some caveats there because a lot of what ends up happening in science is we notice that as we change methods of observation, we observe different characteristics of reality, observables, and we develop a certain distance from what it means to be talking about reality qua reality. And we just talk about our measurable capacity, our instrument, our instruments. Then over here, the next one is more, it's actually pragmatic or evolutionary in a very distinct sense, which has to do with the degree to which behaviors or ways of living play out in the sense that they actually deliver. And the simplest example would be something like a true statement would be something that keeps its promises. So it's not really observables in the world, because it's not the kind of thing that can be tested over and over again. It rather has to do with the a correspondence between behavior and action and assertion. But even more fundamentally would be something like the notion of a true friend, human being who embodies the category of friend in a way that fully and richly completely holds that category well.
Yeah.
or even more simply, the notion that an arrow flies truly, meaning that it hits its target, right? The place that you're targeting is hit. So mm-hmm. it has correspondence between intent and action, or between being, essence, and becoming, or how one actually is. So that's that deeper level of truth. And by the way, I say deep.
Yeah, purpose and progress towards purpose.
Yeah. And the notion mm-hmm. that there is a purpose, and there's a notion of progress, and you can take a look at how they fit. Mm-hmm. So those are distinct epistemologies, right? They're not the same, although they are connected. And what's interesting is, in fact, the journalistic scientific sits on top of now the other one, which I'm going to call the religious. So I'm now opening up the category. So the religious, and this actually does have a bit of an evolutionary sensibility to it. The religious is the category in culture that is concerned with the fitness to purpose of human cultural environments. For example, we're going to go deeper in a minute, but that's a good first step. So, for example, does it cultivate virtue? Does it cultivate wisdom? Does it actually solve all these problems that we've been talking about? Because these problems are problems that emerge in any civilization. And so the toolkit of religion is the toolkit whereby we try to cultivate the set of behaviors, practices, institutions, rituals, techniques, and propositions to properly resolve the problems of civilization, the drift, mm-hmm. our ability to develop novel innovations in the world, and our ability to cultivate and embody adequate wisdom to be able to have the long-term benefit result. And so your proposition you're saying is that a religion that is premised on a lie is an inexorably self-terminating religion, because at some point you will come up against the limitations of where that lie is. And you've made a trade-off. You've made an intrinsically, how do you say it, irreligious trade-off mm-hmm. Of the short-term for the long-term, whatever short-term you're trying to preserve. And I noticed, by the way, that your own first-person experience was an example of that.
Yeah.
There's something true, actually, in what your church was conveying. I hate to tell you this, but cultural elites do actually engage in a wide variety of different kinds of trickery to benefit themselves at the expense of other people.
Yeah.
And so to be aware of that, to be protected from that is a good thing. But if it's captured in a fashion of a lie, this is John Stuart Mill's point, that if there's something bad in the forest and we go out and experience it, we're like, oh my gosh, that's bad. And then we tell our kids there's something bad in the forest, don't go there. And we make up some story like, oh, it's a giant, it's a horrible werewolf monster. And it works in the short term in the sense that our kids don't go to the forest, but our grandkids are now almost allured by this mystery, this myth of what is it? Because they don't know us anymore. They haven't seen the scars on our bodies like our kids did. Mm-hmm. They don't feel it in their belly of, oh man, whatever that is, it's real. I don't really know that the story is true, but what's going on is real. The grandkids don't have that feeling in their belly. They just have the story. They just have the thin narrative, which means they're going to begin to explore. And when they don't discover the big nasty monster, they actually collapses the entire thing you were trying to do. Now they race into the forest and they get eaten by whatever the actual bad thing was. That is a very poorly constructed religion. So one hypothesis, a very good hypothesis, coming from over here almost in the scientific world, is in religious constructs that have endured over very long periods of time and over a large field of contexts are more reliable. It's actually just a general heuristic, they're more reliable. And we can do this. This is kind of like the perennial philosophy effort that came out of the mid-century. I was like, hey, let's do a survey of all religious traditions and let's take a look at the ones that show up all the time and that show up over long periods of time in a variety of contexts. Let's just sort of reify that and say, okay, this is a good basic model of things to be working with. Now, of course, the problem is that approach is itself an application of the analytical methodology we were talking about earlier. Oh, if I try to decontextualize a particular piece of tradition, okay, the Aborigines do this. Let me just pull it out of the context in which it emerged and think that I can identify the two or three key principles. I can sort of optimize for these two characteristics and plop it over here and rewire it to the sort of cyborg religion over here. As it turns out, that's just that's the hubris of modernity, unfortunately applied to the general sensibility that long-standing, well-integrated traditions over long periods of time across a diversity of contexts are more reliable is true. But that doesn't mean that we can analytically dismember them into the principles that we think are the most relevant and then re-coordinate something, at least in any short period of time. I think we if we did that and that endured over a long period of time, then okay, it's gone through the process of becoming resilient. So all of that, by the way, everything I just said there is fully legible within, say, an evolutionary and maybe a cultural anthropological context. Mm-hmm. I don't have to do anything more than that. But then you said something I thought was really beautiful. And this is where the categories of philosophy and theology begin to coincide, which is if you look at this and you say, well, okay, well, what would it look like? If I say that a religion that is premised on a lie is ultimately short-term, and therefore is a bad religion, what would it look like to premise a religion on the truth exclusively? What does that look like if I just, like by fiat, wire that in? Because I can say, from a design perspective, it has to be. And mm-hmm. anything that isn't premised on that way, we can now very clearly erase from the category. At some finite time, the lie will be revealed, and it will, in fact, collapse in some bad way. So now what does it look like to think about trying to design a religion around the set of characteristics that we can identify as being the necessary and sufficient conditions? Now, what are the necessary and sufficient components of any religion that is the best possible? And that's interesting as a problem. Like, what do we mm-hmm. look like to try to do that? Now, I should mention, by the way, that we're in the design language here, which is separate from the notion of wisdom and embodiment.
What is right. It's a very left-brained form of talking about the problem, which, you know, it's not even in McGilchrist's point, isn't that the left brain is bad and the right brain is good? Right. It's, you know, they each have their place. And I do feel like we're at a little bit of a strange moment where we're starting to be a little bit self-conscious of what religion is for, and that this is bringing up questions. Oh, well, maybe we could design one to try and be fit for purpose. Do we need a new religion that's not a religion? Are our religions of the past, you know, is Christianity designed for being a persecuted minority in the Roman Empire, and that's not super relevant at the moment? Is Judaism designed for being an ethnic minority in the Middle East? Is Islam designed for being a conquering force from the Arabian desert? And none of these things, therefore, are fit for purpose for our kind of post-technological meta-crisis age. And therefore, we need to be very self-conscious at, like, doing something new to that's fit for purpose. Is maybe even the Enlightenment. Well, that was for 18th century Scotland, and we're not in 18th century Scotland anymore. And so, you know, the Industrial Revolution, that's old news. We're now in some new thing. And so therefore we need to be very self-consciously throwing off the past. Or is the answer to find the thing, like you were mentioning, that what's the religion that has adapted to the most times and circumstances successfully? It's like, well, it's pretty hard for that answer to not seem like it's Christianity. But does that mean that it'll be fit for purpose because it has survived the most number of, contexts? And so therefore, it's most likely to survive future contexts. I feel like this is a conversation that, as our self-awareness about what religion is and does and is for, is causing us to ask these questions in ways that are new. Because I think previously theologians were just like, well, let's just think about what's true. And I actually think that there's probably a fair amount of wisdom in that. And now we're thinking about, well, what's religion for and how should we design one to meet that need? And I see various conversations in this space. And I think, I don't know, it's a very interesting space. I'm not quite sure what to make of it yet.
Well, we're coming up. We have 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. But we're also coming up to the moment of my conversion. So is historically not bad. Like we're kind of like you mentioned, the religion that's not a religion. So my timeline about two and a half years ago. So the way that I was going about thinking about it was something like, can you identify the characteristics that are, well, okay, there are those things which have proven to be resilient or robust across contexts in history, right? There's some utility to that, but as you say, the possibility landscape of context is arbitrarily large. The fact that it worked over, let's say, 1,000 contexts maybe means nothing if we're looking at 10 billion potential contexts. But we can do a different approach, which is to say, okay, are there things that we can describe that are in principle true across all possible contexts? And it's funny because this is the geometric method. This is the essence of geometry is to orient towards the transcendent, which is to say those things which are independent of context, but are nonetheless true. And that's the thing, what I would say proper theology ends up looking for at its best, to say, okay, what does it mean to try to find a way to build a faculty? And by the way, I'm introducing this concept, but we'll get there in a second. To build a faculty that can engage in the process of trying to identify what is in fact transcendently true, and therefore can be used as the basis for constructing something that is going to be true across all possible contexts. It's no longer bound to particulars. And of course, you know, geometry has studied this. Like, we've done it quite nicely. We can talk about mathematics is talking about increasingly, we can become increasingly rich by noticing that as we change the axiomatics, we can change the particulars of the mathematics, but the axiomatics are happening in the realm of the transcendent, not in the realm of the particulars. So, and this was actually work that was being done in the first and second and third century of Christianity, because this was very much the kind of thing that the Platonists and the Neoplatonists were super into. This was their thing. So, okay, what does it look like to try to think in this way and try to get as refined a compact set of characteristics as necessary? So Neoplatonists in particular, when they start talking about the good, the true, that kind of stuff, which we have inherited, we're interacting with and sometimes crossing over with and debating with and sometimes joining the early Christians. So this is, to me, quite interesting historically. Mm-hmm. So let me say maybe two steps. So and I'll do this first person. So for me, the two steps were first, well, half step. The half step was, oh my gosh, I have been weirdly allergic, I had a weird aversion and blind spot to investigating this entire category for effectively my entire life, which is interesting because I otherwise was quite deeply committed to investigating this problem space for reasons of, you know, meta crisis, and yet was unwilling to actually investigate the Christian piece, the Christian set, the history of that lineage. Okay, so the half step was to stop doing that and investigate it more closely. Then the first step was to begin to become increasingly astounded by the depth and richness of Christian theology with regard and receiving and benefiting from, for example, Greek philosophy and others, with regard to these questions of these transcendents, and not willy-nilly, right? Not just throwing things up randomly, but actually, as far as I can tell, producing the most compact, most complete, necessary and sufficient characteristics for any possible reality, which is the triune, the Trinity. So if you take a look and sort of look at the articulations of the Trinity and as it was being identified in the philosophical, theological domain in the first to third centuries, what I discovered was, oh, okay, so it turns out that's actually it. That is the geometric description of the end point of a complete religion. So now we get to the second step. The second step is shifting, being kicked out of the epistemology of propositions, the epistemology of philosophy, even the epistemology of theology, into the lived embodiment. So what ends up happening, or what ended up happening to me, was as soon as I fully recognized the truth in this sense of the Trinity, I then found myself obligated to begin the process of coming into relationship with the truth of the Trinity in this perspective. And that's where you begin to move out. So there's a gentleman named Schmemann, who's a mid-century Orthodox theologian and father, I'm not quite sure what their nomenclature is, who wrote a book that I've now read quite a bit called For the Life of the World. And he makes a really interesting distinction. He distinguishes between the secular, the religious, and Christianity. In fact, his argument, his proposition that Christianity is an anti-religion, which is quite powerful. But the point there would be to say that religion, as we tend to understand it, can't help but drift over here and become something like a dogmatic set of propositions that identify themselves with schema that are formal, as opposed to over here, which is actually a lived reality, a lived set of relationships. But Christianity, by its calling, if you properly understand its schema, the schema says, stop doing this, come back over here. And it's sort of constantly boots you out of this location into this location. It says, enter into discipleship. Like, this is what we're doing. And we have to enter into a hermeneutics of presence. We have to cultivate within ourselves a capacity to be in relationship with the highest possibility of wisdom and cultivate within ourselves all the different characteristics and dispositions and postures that maximally afford our capacity to grow in embodied wisdom, to say, to grow in character, to grow in what they call toward sainthood, become a saint, become sanctified. So that then moves us into the place I am now, which is that the effort to say, okay, that's what's true here, and now entering into the relationship with truth down here, and entering into that movement on a continuing basis. And here's, for me at least, the most beautiful piece, which is that's also the answer to the meta crisis. Notice how you can connect all these dots, right? Because we say part of the problem of the meta crisis is a cap being captured and addicted in the loops of the left brain, which is saying the loops of endeavoring to use an analytic, intellectual, or intelligence methodology. But the resolution to it is actually to ground ourselves here. So we need to have a religion, which is lives over here as a domain, but we need to have a religion that as it drifts here, its very nature boots us back here even more deeply, so that we're living in this place with more and more groundedness and more solidity. And by the way, with a, that's the right way of describing it, a degree of existential commitment that enables us to go through the transformation. Remember participatory knowing? The level of participatory engagement that is necessary to grow into the reality that we live in. This is not easy. Right? This is a crucible beyond comprehension. And so you need something which says, hey, guess what? Our God embodied himself as an incarnate human and was crucified. Like that, you think you're going through rough stuff. This is the model that we're looking for you to emulate, is a model that says, yeah, you're going to have to go through whatever you have to go through in order to be able to actually fulfill what virtue looks like. You want to be like that? Okay, that's what that did. So this is the anti-Kardashians. And there's more to it. For example, the architecture of, I can't really emulate a transcendent spirit. This is actually interesting enough. So if I look at your background, I think I have Christ in the middle at the top.
Mm-hmm.
Is it Moses on the left? Yeah.
Moses on the left, Elijah on the right.
Okay, so that is all very proper from an emulation perspective. Moses was a real human. Christ was a real human. Elijah was a real human. So I can emulate that. I don't see a picture of the Father in that, unless he's up there on the top right, or is that an angel?
I up there on the right, that's also Jesus at the Transfiguration.
Perfect.
So yeah, that's a different image of the same thing.
Here I'm responding to a really beautiful expression that I heard from Jonathan Pageau about how icons work in Orthodoxy, which is to say they don't draw pictures of the Father. They do draw pictures of the Son, because the Son was incarnate. And you can draw pictures of that which is incarnate, but you can't draw pictures of that which is not incarnate. And so the point is, I can't fully, truly come into an emulation relationship with that which is incarnate. I can't become into a deep, full emulation relationship with the Father, because I can't even perceive the Father. I can't imagine that. But with the Son, I can. So the Son actually provides the interface that allows me to come into that level of full relationality, which then, of course, is I am the way, which then is the path that orients me towards the Father, which is the deepest principles, like the furthest expression of these things that are capital T true, capital G good, and capital B beauty. And so I'm kind of, it's the stuff that I've been living in the past sort of 6 months or so, but that's where I am now.
The image of the invisible God. Yeah. So it seems like it turns out that Christianity is the religion that's not a religion after all.
Yeah, isn't that funny? Already, some people already talked about that probably a long time. They're like, yeah, this is the religion that's not a religion. What do you guys? Yeah, fair enough. Keep talking about it. Stay on that way earnestly. Stick to personal integrity, honesty, and earnest investigation of the truth, and you'll get here. And by the way, the water's fine. Come on in.
Yeah. So, question that I'll ask you, I think that there are a lot of people in this little corner who maybe have been, you know, watching X number of hours of Jordan Peterson, Jonathan Pageau, other related folks like that, and have gotten to a place where it's like, you know, actually religion makes way more sense than I thought it did. Actually, oh, there's a lot more depth in the Bible than I was sort of, you know, had thought growing up. And, you know, maybe I really kind of should go to church. I really should do this business. And it, but it's, there's some obstacle. Like, I think Paul Vanderclay gets these sorts of emails on like perhaps a weekly or daily basis of like, I want to believe, I want to be a Christian, I want to go to church and feel comfortable and be bought in, but I just can't get there. I can't swallow it. I can't cross the river. I can't make the leap of faith, but I kind of want to, but I can't. What would you say to a person that's in that spot?
Well, obviously, this death spot's going to be particular to the person. So the inquiry I would enter into is that, one thing I would do is I would inquire with like using an eternal family systems methodology. What aspect of yourself is the aspect that is holding back? And if you know IFS, this is not to tyrannize or to berate or bully that aspect of giving up what it's holding back, but the opposite, to honor it and say, okay, you're trying to care for something very important. And you're holding the whole of us back in order to care for it. What is it? What is the thing you're caring for? Let's investigate that. So what beautiful, true, critical thing is actually being deeply cared for by an aspect of yourself, which is what is preventing this movement from happening. And live with that, really live with it. And from a place of honor and gratitude. And in some cases, it may actually be, you know, the archetype of the knight who's guarding the thing that no longer is. Like he's living in duty to something where the duty is finally extinguished. And you can allow that knight to be honored and say, thank you for the work that you have done. And your mission is complete. Your mission complete. Everything is protected and safe. We can move on now. Thank you for your service. That kind of a thing. And it may be that the knight is actually protecting something critical that you need to be very careful with and say, okay, let's go on that journey. So let's go to the other side. You know, let's say there is something that's really deep. Like, let's say for you, like you had some process where you had a trauma, right? Being moved from the thing that you grew up in and across that threshold. The only answer is you have to actually go into it with full commitment. There's no other way around it. It's like really from a place of profound love and deep care, investigate carefully. Like what's these things often is the metaphor I've kind of tennis elbow and both elbows from working out too aggressively. And it's hard to heal. I've been working on it now for several months. And it's hard to heal. This is the spiritual elements are even harder to heal. They're bound up in very complex ways. And we run forward in our lives. We have a spiritual a crisis of faith in, let's say, our 20s. And then we live 20 years of our lives never really truly delving into it properly. And so we've built all this structure on top of it. It's all this scar tissue and broken elements. And I don't know if you've ever had a truly effective body worker. You know, these guys, like the thing that like a massage therapist but multiplied by a factor of like 50, like much better. There's a gentleman I worked with in Encinitas, California, by the way, by far the best I've ever been with. And like the second or third time I was working with him, he was like working on my calf or my ankle. And he goes, when did you break your wrist? And my first response was, I've never broken my wrist. And then I thought, wait a minute, hold on. Yeah, in 1996, I was doing Aikido and I took a really hard throw. And I think I actually like really torqued my wrist badly, but I had an exam that like right after that. So I just like taped up my hand and it was like a writing exam. So I was writing with my wrist for like, you know, 7 hours straight. I'm like, yeah, I freaking broke my wrist on that day and it never healed properly. And he's literally like, yeah, this thing, this pain you've got in your lower back, it's actually connected to the way that your body has restructured itself around that broken wrist in 1996. Now we're 30 years later. And that's at the level of the body, right? So the level of the spirit is even more complex. So the answer is, look, you know, care for yourself. Go into these things, go directly into them and do with the level of commitment necessary. And you know, my personal experience, the one that I ended up going through was a combination, let's say the word suffering. But I know that in many, many parts of the West, the word suffering has an intrinsically negative connotation. But that's just etymologically wrong. The word suffer means just to undergo. Experience itself is suffering. Being alive at all is suffering. I don't mean that in a Buddhist sense. I mean it like that's just what the word means. And in the context of suffering, you will also encounter pain. But pain is an experience that is associated with something breaking and or dying. So you know, no pain, no gain is a phrase in the gym. You're breaking muscle tissue. You're causing harm to muscle tissue, but in service to growth. So meaningful pain is a category of suffering. And meaningful pain is what growth is made of. You have to have meaningful pain in order to grow properly. Meaningless pain, okay, we can box that off. We don't want to engage in meaningless pain. And here's the beautiful part. You never have to actually engage in meaningless pain. More and more you're able to actually grasp how to live in life. You begin to be able to metabolize the pain you're experiencing in deeper registers and be able to grow through and through it. So the offering would be something like suffer. Suffer the suffering that you need to suffer, to experience the pain you need to experience, to get fully in relationship with the most meaningful, which is to say, to heal yourself in the places you need to heal, so that if you feel a yearning to delve into, let's say, deep relationship, you know, the word church, I don't mean an institution. I don't mean go to that box over there with a cross on top. What I mean is come into fully intimate relationship with other human beings who are ready, willing, and able to come into that fully intimate relationship with you in the context of a joint journey towards the highest possibilities. That's going to church. And in some sense, this little corner is a version of that. It's kind of like not deep enough, obviously, because you're not actually raising your kids together. One of the measures I used when I was talking about what does it mean to be in a real community? You know you're in a real community when your neighbor's grandkids will be at your funeral. Because it makes sense. Because there's real relationship there. There's an intimacy. Yeah. You know each other well enough. That's like they love you in a way that makes it make sense for them to be at your funeral, your neighbor's grandkids. Same thing here, right? So, and that's an easy path because we know we need that. Like we know that one of the things that our culture is that the meaning crisis is both the deepest wound, but also the shortest and most needed path. We need meaning, and meaning is found in relationship. It's simple as that. And so build relationship and become one who is more and more capable of more meaningful relationship. Well, that requires painful suffering, meaningful, painful suffering. So, yeah, so I guess that's what I have to say.
Sure. So I can understand how we would have, you know, exercising in a gym. Yeah, that feels like suffering sometimes. This body worker massage person might have to cause some discomfort before you get out on the other side of it. What would be the equivalent of that for a Christian nowadays? What's the suffering that we voluntarily put ourselves through that isn't just masochistic, that is producing the sort of growth that leads to sanctification?
I mean, the whole category of confession is contained there, right? Mm-hmm. Of course, the potency of confession is, in fact, the actual real feeling, mm-hmm. actually allowing yourself to truly feel the degree to which you've been doing wrong, and I mean, particularly doing wrong to people who you love. Mm-hmm. Like truly acknowledging that you have been doing wrong to people you love in a category of neither of not protecting yourself nor of self-flagellation, but actually just allowing that to be there and then allowing the reality of that not to be annulled or disappeared by simple fiat, but actually to be lived into. And so the answer is something like, you know, stop being addicted to cocaine. Stop being mean to your wife, right? Stop, you know, and understand why these things happen. Break old bad habits, build new good habits. That's actually the Christian mandate. We have grow into being Christ. It was repent, break old bad habits. Mm-hmm. Discipleship, build new good habits. Mm-hmm. How do we do that? Well, we confess. And we don't confess in propositional world. We confess in over here in truth, like in the deeper truth world, which means mm-hmm. we acknowledge, and then we begin the process of learning more and more deeply what are the roots and how do we build, like how do we actually do it practically? And this is back, kind of going to the spiritual gym. So that kind of stuff. Like I think it's a practicum. It's not an oath. Not a thing to sign on a document and say, yeah, I'm a Christian now. So it's a fully committed way of life.
Mm-hmm. All right. I think I'll bring us to a close here, but I'll give you one last question. Any closing thoughts or remarks that you want to share before we wrap up?
Well, the thing that was coming to me is that what I've noticed in all these many different conversations is the path of relationality. So our conversation has been a conversation that's had a certain flavor to it, maybe mm-hmm. a timbre. Mm-hmm. There's certain people for whom this is a good conversation. There's other people for whom this is not going to be a good conversation. And that's quite beautiful, right? Because what we want is we actually want to have not one size fits all. This is sort of the anti-algorithmic sensibility, or even like an algorithm is able to give a YouTube video, weirdly enough, we're hijacking the YouTube algorithm to do this. But we actually want it to be based on a real relationship, like real kinship, something like proper church, but in a distributed fashion. And so I'm glad, I'm really grateful that you reached out, because I feel like this is an aspect of the story that hasn't been shared yet, from my point of view, and an aspect of the story that I care about quite deeply. The people who have these sort of concerns and backgrounds are people that, if you mean my life story, this is my tribe, because these are the people that I come from.
Mm-hmm. Well, great. I appreciate that. And I agree that every conversation hits people differently, and that we don't need to save the whole world in one fell swoop. But part of, I think, good dialogue can have some of that, and not that it was suffering to talk to you, but it can have some of that refining aspect too, where we shave off some parts of ourselves that we realize were not true in both senses of that word, and grow together. And that dialogue is one of the exercises of the Christian life that can help lead us to Christ.
Okay, beautiful.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, everybody, for listening.